Women's Wellness Today, Wednesday, May 9th, 2007. And Mr. Junetoff.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Junetoff from Oregon Advocacy Center. Thank you for inviting me today to give the report that Oregon Advocacy Center is mandated by statute to give each legislative session regarding the implementation of Oregon's involuntary sterilization laws. These are laws that were passed back in the early 80s, changing completely the way that Oregon addressed the issue of how decisions can be made for people who are unable to give consent for their own sterilization, and putting a procedure in place in the courts in order to make determinations of whether sterilization is appropriate or not appropriate. And this is generally dealing with people with severe disabilities. And was put into place because back before 1983, Oregon had a State Board of Social Protection that was given the authority under state law to make decisions about sterilizing individuals with disabilities. And it also had much more elaborate social hygiene laws, which implemented the theory of eugenics, which was that the state could somehow affect the genetic makeup of its citizens by sterilizing certain people whom the state felt were had genetic defects that might be passed on to their children. And so back in those days, for example, any resident of Fairview Training Center had to be sterilized in order to be discharged from that facility, in order, in the state's view, to guard against those individuals procreating and potentially producing children who had disabilities. What we've learned since then, scientifically, is that there is no linkage between an individual having Down syndrome or autism and passing that on to their children. But in those days, that was the belief, and so we had laws that stepped in and did that. In 1983, the legislature created a new system in order to regulate this area. And essentially what it does is it recognizes some of the basic aspects of medical decision making. And that is, of course, in Oregon, from the age of 15 on, an individual is considered to be competent to make medical decisions for themselves. And sterilization is generally considered to be a medical procedure. And so as in any medical procedure, if an individual, any physician, agree on a particular course of conduct in terms of treatment, that procedure can go forward with what's called informed consent. In other words, the patient is given all the information they need to make that decision. And that is the case for all medical procedures, including sterilization in Oregon. What the new law in 83 did was it set up what it basically said was, number one, was that while what I just stated is true, that people can make decisions for themselves, it stated that if a person cannot make a decision for themselves, or there's some question, if a physician feels that there is some question of whether the person's capable of making a medical decision for themselves, then there will be a court proceeding available in order to make that determination. In other words, to decide, does this individual have the ability to make the decision? And if the person does, then that person is essentially authorized to go ahead and, with the agreement of the physician, make that type of medical decision. But if not, then there is a procedure in place in order to determine whether it's in the person's best interest to go ahead and do that. Again, in Oregon, between the eight, it is prohibited for a person to be sterilized if they cannot give consent before the age of 18. So in those teenage years, even if it was in the person's best interest to have that done for some reason, that is prohibited. Again, that's the primary purpose for going ahead and doing a procedure. if sterilization was a secondary effect of having to treat some other problems, such as ovarian cancer, for example, then that isn't governed by this law. This is strictly governing situations in which the desired end is the sterilization of the person. In those cases where a person is 18 or older, there is a thorough court proceeding that's in place and standards that are in place in order for a judge to weigh in terms of making a determination. And part of that law designated the Oregon Advocacy Center, which I'm the director, to monitor the process. And it requires that if any proceeding is filed in the state of Oregon under this law, that the Oregon Advocacy Center and the state court administrator are supposed to be notified of that fact. And the Advocacy Center is supposed to play a technical assistance role should those situations arise. And then the law goes on to say that we are to come to you every 2 years to report about what we've seen in the last 2 years and to make any recommendations that we consider to be relevant to how the law is operating. All of that having been said, the Advocacy Center doesn't receive very many reports or filings usually. I would say I've been working at the Advocacy Center for over 20 years now, and probably the most we've received in any two-year period have been four. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that every time one of these procedures goes forth that the court proceeding is used and so forth, and we'll only learn about the matters if there is a court proceeding. But sometimes, in addition to that, we'll also receive complaints because our office is associated with this procedure. Sometimes people who are concerned that some type of sterilization may be improperly going forward will complain to us, and we will then conduct an investigation in order to determine if what's going on. And in the last 2 years, and that's what I'm here to report to you about, in the last 2 years, we have not received any formal notifications regarding sterilization proceedings in the state of Oregon. The one incident that we did receive a complaint about, I've outlined in my testimony, and that had to do with a situation in which we received an anonymous complaint there was a teenage girl with mild mental retardation who was living with her grandparents. Grandparents were the legal guardians. They had consulted a physician and scheduled a sterilization procedure to go forward. We had, in response to that complaint, our office attempted to contact the doctor and the hospital patient advocates and the grandparents. The doctor and the patient advocate never responded to our contacts, but the grandparents did, and we provided the grandparents with all the information about the procedure. And in the materials that I provided to you, the last six pages are straight from our website, which is a guide to Oregon sterilization law, and it's in a question and answer format. It attempts to, in a fairly friendly way, which is always a challenge when you're dealing with legal requirements, sets out the requirements of the sterilization statute. And after the grandparents reviewed this, they informed us that they did not plan to go ahead with the procedure. At least at that point. And they did understand that the law prohibited this type of procedure to be done while the girl remained under 18. I might add that in past years we had recognized that many doctors were not familiar with this law. And about 2 years ago, when I gave a report to the legislature, we had made arrangements with the State Board of Medical Examiners to put an article in their publication talking about the sterilization law, and that was done. Kathleen Haley, the director of that organization, had agreed to that, and so we had done some outreach in that area, I think there's probably more to be done, but that was one effort we made to reach doctors. At that point, 2 years ago, we had discussed the idea of creating some specific liability for a doctor if the doctor didn't follow this procedure, because even though there are directives in state law about what is to be done, there is no penalty, specific penalty under the law for not following the court procedures. A person could file, a person who had been improperly sterilized could potentially file a lawsuit because this procedure was done to them without their consent or legal authority, although our sense was that that would be highly unlikely for a disabled person to go ahead and do that. And the only incidences that the Board of Medical Examiners were able to find in which a doctor had been, there had been a complaint about a doctor going ahead and performing a sterilization that was not approved by the law, the Board of Medical Examiners had issued a letter of concern to those doctors, and that was the extent of the penalty in those instances. And what they had found is that the doctor just wasn't familiar with the law. The legislature was not comfortable in moving ahead and putting teeth, as I would put it, into the statute at that time, and basically recommended that we move ahead and try to advertise a little bit more what their requirements are into the medical profession. As I said, we haven't received any, other than this particular complaint, we haven't received any other complaints during the last 2 years.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the issue of penalties, and you've included in here an article about the little girl who was maimed by her family by having her uterus removed as a child in order to keep her small. Am I correct that even in that case, there is not going to be any penalty to her parents, to the doctors, to the physicians, even though they all violated state law and Ashley's rights in performing that procedure?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, that's correct. And thank you for bringing me to the situation that's happening in Washington State. And I attached a copy of a newspaper article from yesterday, because this is a matter that occurred up in Washington State. I actually learned about this because I got a call from the Bend Bulletin many months ago saying, have you heard about this? And I hadn't, and asked for comment. And it involved a situation in which a 6.5-year-old girl with significant disabilities was given high doses of hormones in order to slow down her regular growth patterns, and then her parents and physician had her given a full hysterectomy and removal of her breast buds in order to retard any further growth or maturation on her part. This became a public matter, for one thing, because the parents actually have a website it has a blog that documents the entire process that they've gone through and what their justifications were. I think it's important to bring this to your attention, not only because it's received national attention and with the debate that surrounded it and some of the implications that it might have here in Oregon. And I'd just like to talk about those for a minute. In this particular case, the parents' stated reason for going ahead and doing this was that they felt that they wanted to keep Ashley at home as she grew older, and that she matured and became larger, physically larger, that it would be difficult to transport her and to move her, and that as long as she was small, it would be they would be able to do that with any without any assistance or supports, and they want their main concern, as they stated, was to keep her at home and in the family. They also noted some concerns that she might contract some diseases that are associated with womanhood, and they wanted to avoid those. And they also noted that they didn't expect Ashley to ever be to have the ability to procreate because of her disabilities, and so they didn't feel that that was raised a problem. There's been an enormous debate that has occurred around this issue nationally, and there's a few things that I think are important to bring up around that. One is that from there is a particular perspective in the disability world about the dignity and that people are given as people with disabilities, and they're just as with the Fairview situation and so many others, the history is rife with people with significant disabilities being treated as less than human. And from the disability perspective, taking this type of drastic action with any other human being is a demonstration that this person is not being treated as a functional human being, and can be surgically and medically altered for the convenience of other people. When I was asked by the Penn Bulletin of what the alternative might have been for the parents, I'd say, well, one of the things that we do at the legislature is we come in and we advocate for supports and in-home supports and the types of services that people need in order to keep folks at home. DV advocates have been here this session advocating for the supports that families need to keep their children out of nursing facilities and in the homes, and those are the types of supports that allow that to happen. Even with the best of intentions, it's troubling that when given potentially being in a situation where a parent must choose between institutionalizing their child or potentially resorting to this type of intervention, surgical intervention, that's a terrible choice to place before a person, and I think highlights the need for us to provide the supports and help those parents to have the supports they need to keep their children in their homes. The other thing about that I wanted to note about the Ashley situation is that Washington does not have a statute like Oregon does. It has Washington law, like Oregon law, prohibits guardians from approving sterilization, and the investigation report that was done by our sister agency in Washington found that in this particular case, if the parents had gone ahead and the hospital had gone ahead and allowed the surgery to happen without proper authorization from the courts, because the guardian there did not have the authority. Washington doesn't provide for an alternative mechanism. It just says there needs to be some sort of a court order, but it doesn't lay out a procedure, whereas Oregon does. So I think in that respect, Oregon is ahead of the game in setting out procedures in this area, if they are in fact followed. And so I think that we can feel good about that. However, given the nature of the debate around this problem, I think that we're likely to see more situations like this. And I think that one of the areas that we may need to grapple with in the future have to do not only with surgical interventions, but pharmacological interventions. And we have seen here in Oregon situations in the last couple of years having to do with children with disabilities being given medications in order to retard or slow or eliminate their maturation process because of concerns about their developing into sexuality. And right now, there are very few, if any, guidelines surrounding that type of intervention. There are ethics committees at hospitals, if there's a hospital involved. But beyond that, there really isn't much guidance in terms of what is an appropriate or inappropriate use of medications that significantly delay growth. The types of situations that this arise can be delicate. For girls, oftentimes the issues that arise have to do with the fear of pregnancy and the inconvenience of menses for women when they need to have caretakers, and a concern for the psychological effects of premenstrual symptoms for people with severe disabilities. Those are the ones that we hear most commonly. For men, it's concern about developing sexuality that might be problematic as they age. And in the cases that we've seen, in the last couple of years have been those types of cases with men. Actually, boys whose maturation is delayed because of concerns about their becoming sexual people.
May
I ask a question? Yes. Thank you. In the cases of boys, young men, teenagers who have had this experience because of concerns about developing sexuality or inappropriate acting out, what types of educational resources had been provided to these young men in terms of understanding the changes in their bodies, understanding appropriate behaviors, understanding appropriate interactions when one has sexual feelings about another person? Are these programs available? Is this an area we need to improve on for people with disabilities in terms of sex education?
Representative Gilzer, as far as I know, there were not those types of education provided for those individuals. We're still investigating at least one of these cases now, and as far as we know, there was his concerns about a young boy, and the caretakers looked to the medical profession for some type of remedy rather than looking for any type of education or social supports for the remedy. And that this echoes in some ways the concern I raised that sometimes people will look to the medical profession for some sort of surgical or pharmacological answer to a particular problem rather than supports or education that might be provided to help a situation or a feared situation. So these are things that we might anticipate, and the reason I bring them up is that I'm hoping to work with folks at the Department of Human Services in the coming year to start to look at those situations to see if there are ways to address them. I think this is a very delicate area, and that's one of the reasons we're not coming in here and asking for a particular statutory change in order to address it, because I think we need to study it and see how prevalent the use of medications are in this area and whether there's a way to address it. Our concern is just that somehow with the development of medicine, the technology of medicine, that merely looking at sterilization, it may be a little bit too narrow in the future. There's just lots of different types of interventions that are being developed that are extremely intrusive on a person, and they need a closer look. And there does, as far as we can tell right now, there isn't a lot of guidelines. There aren't in the medical profession, and we need to do some investigation to see what's out there and what standards there may be in order to address this. And that sort of brings me to my closing point is that we at the Advocacy Center have been given a responsibility that's really to bring a disability perspective into this area, this very delicate area, and our disability perspective is to uphold the fact that people with disabilities are human beings and that they should be respected as human beings and treated as human beings. And our sterilization laws recognize that and reflect that perspective, and that's very important to this community. And when other types of interventions start to create inroads into that area, it's something we think is very important to look at so that we can come back potentially to you to make recommendations or to take other steps to create safeguards. And that's what we hope to do.
Thank you, Mr. Judendieff. Any further questions, Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to go back to a comment that you made and just ask you to say a little bit more about it. You mentioned that at least one of the tools that we might have for examining this was ethics departments at hospitals. I know that OHSU has a whole center on ethics. Were you saying that it's a possibility to maybe have them examine this, or that they had maybe written on this, or you know, what has been done or what's available there?
Chair Representative Gilliam, we've worked with ethics committees at hospitals on this issue as well as on end-of-life issues. My frank assessment is that it's a mixed bag, depending upon the facility. Again, from the disability perspective, one of the recommendations in the Washington report, by the way, is that the hospital that was involved in that case have a person on their ethics committee who brings a disability perspective. I think that's an excellent idea. One of the concerns that disability advocates have generally is that ethics committees, there isn't a formalized makeup of an ethics committee. It's generally internalized to that institution. And we have seen situations in which an ethics committee was, in fact, one individual who was respected in that facility. But from our perspective, had a number of factors to weigh and wasn't familiar with the perspective that we bring, at least, to the matter. For example, one factor we've seen, at least in some hospitals, is that there is a great respect for the relationship between the physician and the patient's family, which, of course, there should be, and sometimes that honoring that relationship and that doctor family decision making process needs to be weighed against some of these questions of the individual disabilities and their rights and the perspective of how their life should be treated. And at least from our perspective, sometimes that isn't given sufficient weight, and that's really the debate and discussion. And if you look at the Ashley situation and some of the debate that's happened nationally on this, you'll see that, at least in my perspective, some of that is what's going on, is that how much deference should we be giving in making these decisions to the family's concerns and the family's I would say convenience, and that may be a loaded word, but at least their perspective on the matter and their decision-making as to what's best for their child and what isn't, and how should that be weighed against the integrity of that person. And those are difficult issues, and if you don't, but what I'm suggesting is that if there isn't a disability perspective at the table, I don't think you can have a full discussion, and we don't often find that, when, at least in the cases we've been involved in.
Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a comment that I think one of the challenges that's highlighted by this whole issue is when we talk about people with disabilities as a culture, I think we have a tendency to medicalize the issues and the problems that are surrounding that. I think for any of us that are raising children when they're in their teenage years, their sexual development is something of great concern. Will they make appropriate choices? Might there be an unintended pregnancy? For our children who aren't disabled, we talk to them, we provide them with education, we provide them with good medical information, and we talk to them about the values of our families. For people with disabilities, we tend to jump to what's the medical intervention to fix this problem. And often a person with an intellectual disability, although their ability to do math or reading might be different than the average person on the street, they will still experience normal, healthy sexual development. And rather than a medical intervention which denies that individual that very human expression of affection, perhaps we would be better to step back from those medicalized responses and instead look at what type of education do we provide to other kids. If we think about a typically developing 15-year-old boy who acts out inappropriately sexually, I think it would be very unusual to think of medical castration for that individual. It's inappropriate to do that for a person with a disability simply because they have an intellectual disability. I think in terms of Ashley, the issue, which are very real issues about lifting and in-home support, again, those weren't issues that were related to this child's uterus or her ovaries. Those were issues that could have been resolved with lifts and in-home supports, things that are very practical rather than medical. But we tend to, with people with disabilities, put everything back in a hospital setting. And I think we do that to families as well when they bring their children home. When I worked as a parent educator, I taught a class that was called Living and Learning with Your Child with Special Needs, and we worked on behavioral kinds of things. And one of my favorite conversations was someone that came to the class, and they were frustrated because the child was pulling things out of the cabinet and throwing things on the floor, and they were going back to the developmental pediatrician, and they were wondering if there were recommendations from other families, if there were medications that they had tried. Well, the child was 2.5. That's the job of a 2.5-year-old, is to create chaos in the kitchen. Sometimes there are things that are caused by a disability. Sometimes people with disabilities develop, even though their development may be delayed, in ways that are very typical because they're human beings. And I think in this case and in others, if we can recognize that, rather than jumping to a hospital ethicist or a surgery or another medication to stop something that is actually a healthy developmental milestone for an individual, it would make a big difference. This is just such a sad topic, and it's just indicative of the way that we don't think about people with disabilities as humans. We wouldn't think about doing this to non-disabled people.
And I'm sure I just add that I agree completely with Representative Gelser on this, not surprisingly. I did also want to point out that I did attach the proclamation from Governor Kitzhaber apologizing for the hundreds of forced sterilizations in earlier Oregon history. And I attach it both to remind us of that, but also to emphasize that this really is an evolving area. And what seemed to be absolutely appropriate and proper 30 years ago, or 50 years ago, now we recognize was not, and it's my sense that we're continuing to evolve in this area, and so some of the issues that I brought to you today are I think just alerting you that with our abilities now to turn to work with genetics, to work with new medical procedures, to work with new medicines, I think we're going to have continuing ethical challenges in this area, and I think it's just important for us to continue to be aware of those so that we can respond appropriately.
Thank you so much. There are several other people in the audience. Any of you wish to speak on this today? Okay. So, but before you go, thank you so much for your presentation and your interest in this issue. You know, I've been on the Human Services and Health Committee for 3 terms, and I don't think I ever heard you give one of these presentations. Did you? To whom did you give your every 2 year presentation?
Madam Chair, it varies. I think the last session it was Senate Judiciary. Because we had a bill, as I mentioned earlier, we the bill had suggested putting some teeth in this area, and so the report accompanied that piece of legislation. The session before that, we also we had a recommendation that was actually enacted that that had to do with. The fact that some practitioners were using this procedure for people who had questionable abilities to make decisions, using the proceedings to get a court finding that the person had the capacity to make decisions, so that they could go ahead and approve it on their own when they were six. In the example that we had, a 16-year-old boy, and. That's a big decision to make as a 16-year-old, no matter what your capacity, mm-hmm. of course. What our bill at that point was very modest. I thought was that a court should not enter an order finding an individual has capacity unless the court actually physically had an opportunity to interact with the individual. And we had seen an instance in which a court had approved a finding of capacity without a hearing based upon affidavits. We felt that if a judge is going to go ahead and do that, the judge should at least have an opportunity mm-hmm. to talk to that individual. And in fact, that bill was enacted and the law was amended at that time.
Well, I would hope that in the future, that every 2 years, I would love to be hearing from you, and I think probably this committee would too. I think this is a very important issue, and as you said, a very delicate issue. So I commend you for the work that you've done, and please keep us advised. And if there is legislation that needs to happen, oh, and not just legislation, but you mentioned physicians not knowing that this is the law. Whatever we can do, and we hope you take whatever measures that are in your power to educate physicians on what the law is, and if there's anything that the legislature can do to encourage that, enable that, then please let us know. I think this is an issue that this committee is very interested in.
Thank you
very much. Any further questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much, Mr. With that, I'm closing this public information portion of the hearing. We have a meeting on Friday, and we have several issues, Senate Bill 379 and 16A and 364A. And probably we won't have a meeting on Monday, is that correct?
Sure.
The bills are sort of, oh, I know, Representative, you just hate having another.
We're going to get through it, though.
Yes, we are. But they're just sort of slowly coming in. We will be having more bills to be dealing with, but we won't be having a meeting on Monday morning. Representative Gillian.
What are those numbers? What are they?
Okay. 379, Senate Bill 379, directs education providers to provide to school employees training on child abuse prevention and identification and to make training available to parents, legal guardians, and students. That's a good one.
First hearing.
16A would change the composition of the interdisciplinary team coordinating hospice care. And 364 requires the Director of Human Services to establish Consumer Advisory Council to advise Director on provision of mental health services by the Department of Human Services. So those should be.
I know.
You know?
No, I was just voting on.
Oh.
Move things along.
I'll take care of it. I'll take care of that.
Okay, thank you.
The guy is a freshman.
My responsibility.
Yes, it is. Yes. All right.
Make sure we move along.
Yes, we're going to move on. Any other questions or concerns? Thank you all for being here today. And I close the Health Committee on Human Services and Women's. Oh, wait.
I'm gone.
We have, no, you're not. We're going to sing happy birthday.
Whose birthday?
Susan.
Okay.
Hey.
Please turn the table.